Welcome to the Sports Docs Podcast. I'm Dr. Ashley Bassett.
And I'm Dr. Catherine Logan.
On each episode, we chat about the most recent developments in sports medicine and dissect through all the noise so you know which literature should actually impact your practice. Today, we're continuing our special series of episodes to recap the newest research presented at the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons annual meeting, our largest orthopedic conference. This year, over 20,000 orthopedic professionals gathered at the AOS annual meeting in San Francisco to take part.
On this episode, we are recapping some of the standout posters presented at AOS with Dr. Megan Bishop. If you haven't listened to our last mini episode, what are you waiting for? Go check it out and hear all about the AOS meeting. But today, we're just going to dive right in.
If you're looking for a trusted name in osteochondral allograft transplantation, look no further than JRF Ortho. With a stellar track record and a reputation as the leader in fresh osteochondral allografts, JRF Ortho is here to elevate your practice to new heights.
JRF Ortho has proudly distributed over 25,000 allografts worldwide, making a significant impact in the field. Their passion for this industry goes beyond the numbers. It's about helping patients and fulfilling their mission of improving people's quality of life.
But that's not all. At JRF Ortho, they understand that superior customer care is crucial. They aim to give you one less thing to think about so you can focus on what matters the most, your patients.
And they make ordering JRF Ortho easy. They are committed to accommodating your needs and delivering allografts on your terms.
You're in control. Choose your scheduling option, whether it's specifying a surgical date, providing a date range, or just requesting the earliest available allograft. Your preferences are their top priority.
So, prepare for success. Order with JRF Ortho and take control of your orthopedic journey.
Hey, Megan. Welcome back to the show.
Ashley, Catherine, thanks for having me back.
Yay. I'm like, woo.
Well, you have a lot to woo about because we love this topic, shoulder instability.
It's one of our favorites.
Yeah.
So the next poster we're going to discuss is titled Primary Laterje Procedure versus Laterje in the Setting of a Previously Failed Anchor Repair, a Systematic Review. So we've spoken a lot about shoulder instability on this podcast, most recently with Yoni Rosenblatt last month, discussing rehab tips and tricks after shoulder stabilization surgery. We also had Brian Lau on episodes 48 and 49 to chat about the different surgical options for anterior shoulder instability. So we're really excited to review this poster and add some new literature to the discussion. So before we dive into the results of this paper, Megan, we wanted to quickly discuss your approach to the surgical treatment of anterior shoulder instability. So what are some patient factors or imaging findings that may push you towards a primary Laterje versus proceeding with an initial Bankart repair?
Yeah, so a lot of factors that go into this, but I think when it comes down to kind of the main factor is I'm looking at bone loss. So we talk about that like 20% critical bone loss on the glenoid. If patients obviously have more than that, I'm leaning towards doing some kind of bony procedure like a Laterje. So that's probably my main indication for it. Anything less than that, you know, and if it's a primary procedure, I might, and depending on the patient, obviously if they're a contact athlete versus not a contact athlete based on their age and risk factors like that, I would lean towards doing more of a soft tissue procedure or just a, you know, anterior labral Bankart repair versus doing a bony procedure first. But that 20% is still pretty much my indication for going straight to a Laterje. I just find with Laterje, I still get a little bit nervous about the complication rates and things like that with it to go there as a primary procedure when I know I can do a good soft tissue Bankart repair plus or minus a remplissage to be able to augment that.
Yeah, I'm on the same page. And we've had folks on before that'll, you know, talk about, you know, in the professional athlete world that there's almost like trends sometimes. I'm trying to remember what Dr. Price said, if he said, Dr. Price was with the, the NFL, it was like doing soft tissue kind of procedures. Mm-hmm. The NHL, you know, they're often going straight to Laterje. And then, you know, other guys in the league will say like, well, that guy had a Laterje, that guy had a Laterje. And then it just becomes the standard of care. But I'm with you, you know, I use that sort of bone loss as my guide. But as far as, you know, the study, so it was a systematic review. So Dr. Peter Millett at the Stedman Clinic in Vail, he compared outcomes of the Laterje in the setting of a previously failed Bankart versus those, doing a Laterje as the primary surgery. So the authors found a significantly higher rate of complications, recurrent instability, and revision surgery after Lattergé as a revision procedure for failed Bankart compared to primary, which, you know, makes sense, I think. But Meg, do these results surprise you at all? Does this, you know, what do you think about Lattergé after Bankart repair? Why do you think there is more like inferior outcomes as opposed to primary Lattergé?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the idea of this study is probably to push more people towards doing the right procedure first, because obviously any kind of revision procedure is going to have a higher rate of complications and things like that. So the findings of the study aren't necessarily that surprising to me, that patients, even though they just had, you know, soft tissue anchors and things like that placed in it before, that they would have a higher chance of failure and instability and revisions after for a secondary procedure. So it doesn't necessarily surprise me. I just think that obviously you probably need to make sure you're looking at your indications correctly, looking at the patient correctly, and doing the right primary procedure in your hands. But you know, the one thing I did note on this, they did have similar rates of redislocation. I know that they had a higher rate of instability for the revision Lattergé, which I must be subjective instability. They didn't really describe what that was, but the rate of actual frank redislocations was the same for primary, because I would actually have a very hard time imagining. I think it's a pretty low risk of redislocation after Lattergé, so it's actually really hard to do that. It's 2.8% versus 3.4%. So those were pretty similar, which is always going to be your primary outcome.
So Megan, I actually found this paper is actually published. So when I was kind of looking at these posters, I actually was able to find this paper, and they say it's subluxations versus dislocation. So I think
as you're saying, you're alluding
to, yeah. So it's feeling a sensation of a subluxation, but no actually diagnosis of like that kind of Hill-Sachs, that bony edema that we see with a re-injury that we would see with a dislocation. So
right.
I think exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the point you made about trying to push people to do the right surgery, I think it's important. I think it's also the complication rate. Like I, for many years, was always quoting a complication rate of 30%. I think newer literature is suggesting between 4 to 6%, but those are in surgeons that do Lattergés a ton, right? And so I think I interpret this with a bit of caution. I think, yes, of course, 20% critical bone loss. Like you have to do a bony restoration procedure, whether that's a Lattergé or a distal tibia allograft. But I think the idea of doing a Lattergé in like 12%, bone loss just because it maybe provides a bit more stability, negating that complication risk. I don't know if I'm there yet. So I think it definitely is a balance. It's kind of the approach that you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think like going to do like a revision, soft tissue Bankart repair versus going to do a Lattergé as a second procedure. Like I think you should probably be leaning towards a Lattergé for anyone that's kind of failed their first procedure. I think the outcomes of doing a revision soft tissue Bankart repair are usually, you know, not going to be very good. So like, I think this is a great, for me in my practice still, unless, like I said, that critical bone loss of 20%, a Lattergé is going to be for revision failed soft tissue Bankart. But I don't think you should be doing like multiple soft tissue Bankarts before you go to that, I guess.
Agree.
Yeah.
I think that all makes sense. And I also think there's a very big difference between like a very early failure, someone who like fails, like say a soft tissue procedure within like the early stages of recovery, because maybe they have a trauma or, you know, something like that. They fall, they slip, go back, you know, something too soon versus something that's like, oh, I had this done 10 years ago and now it's failed. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of complexity in all those decisions, but I agree with you both that I'm not there for like doing it as a primary procedure when the bone, you know, is, you know, not on the side of something that would make me lean towards, okay, there's a lot of glenoid bone loss there. But I do think, you know, Dr. Millett always does really good studies, really well done. It's nice that the paper's out there. So we'll put the links to the papers for people to access it if they want to sort of dip down into the details. But Ashley, I can't remember if you pointed this out already, but like, you know, the idea of any revision surgery, like the anatomy has already changed. So, mm-hmm. When you're now like doing a Lattergé after there's been, you know, a primary soft tissue procedure and that person's having that recurrent sort of subluxation, you know, that makes me also think like, have we really restored, you know, like their motion well, or do they just sort of feel like, no, my anatomy is altered and this just doesn't feel right? You know?
I also think something interesting the paper pointed out as to why the inferior outcomes is that, you know, recurrent instability, it can lead to a whole host of issues. We know from that paper, Carolyn Hetrich published about delay in treatment for primary instability being associated with more cartilage and more significant labrum injury and bone loss, and compromising those outcomes even after a primary vanguard. Yeah. I think similar here, like if they've redislocated, if they've re-injured, like they've probably damaged some cartilage, they've sheared off more bone, they've compromised the anterior soft tissues, they probably are going to have an inferior outcome as a proxy, as a consequence of that second injury that they
see. Or even just like their scapulohumeral rhythm is just awkward, and you know, just like everything about their biomechanics is a little bit off. So I think if you're sort of assuming they have an excellent physical therapist who's going to identify all those things, awesome, but you know, not everybody's going to be able to get that. So if all those patterns aren't corrected and all those compensatory things that they've been dealing with, you know, that also adds to, you know, those layers that we really can't get from a paper, you know.
Exactly. I still think this is like good data to have though, just in terms of kind of counseling patients and letting them know that you still can have a good outcome after this revision surgery. However, we do know that you might have a, you know, higher chance of having some complications or, you know, a revision procedure, things like that. So it's good to be able to use this to counsel patients. One thing I found interesting at specialty day, just at AOS last week when I was there, is that we had a section that was on shoulder instability, and a lot of people are doing kind of remplissage with their primary Bankart, soft tissue Bankart repairs pretty much for everybody, like at this point. So like people are kind of doing a remplissage almost on everyone, even if they don't have a large Hill-Sachs lesion or things like that, especially in contact athletes. Mm-hmm. So I do think that's actually something that's pretty quick to be able to add to your procedure. That, you know, some people can get a little loss of external rotation with a remplissage. That's one thing that you have to kind of counsel your patients about, but it does seem to, a lot of the literature that they were presenting at specialty day are leading towards that being a good addition to some of these soft tissue procedures to help kind of boost lower our rates of recurrent instability after the procedure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, agree.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Sports Docs. We hope you enjoyed our discussion as much as we did. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and YouTube to stay up to date on all things sports medicine. If you like what you hear, please consider leaving us a review. We also love to see your comments and hear about your questions. You can reach us by email at sportsdocspod@gmail.com or find us on Instagram at the Sports Docs Pod and Twitter at the Sports Doc Pod. We love your feedback.